could talk a little louder. I could talk a little louder, but I won't. But I won't.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Bonnie Montgomery? Y'all like Bonnie? Bonnie Montgomery, a native Arkansan, is a classically trained opera singer by day and a honky-tonk queen by night. In addition to her classic country show, Montgomery composed the modern folk opera, Billy Blythe, about Bill Clinton's childhood. During the last year, Bonnie appeared on MSNBC and in the pages of The New Yorker, Huffington Post, The New York Observer, Time, and other publications. Cruel, a three-song EP, will be released on the Fast Weapons label out of Portland, Oregon this spring. A neo-romantic Americanist composer, Montgomery is an advocate of bar opera, where she resides in Little Rock, Arkansas. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark played on the late legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, grapevineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week's stories are all about friendship, the power of, the lasting impact of, and the honesty of. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Pat Gillum's summer and life is forever changed with a visitor, and we'll end the night with Susan Elder as she runs into an old friend unexpectedly. But let's start the night with George McLeod as he goes to visit a long-lost friend in How's Your Mama and Nim?
In the summer of 1977, I went on a business trip to New York. On the day I arrived, I went to the theater and bought a ticket for that evening's performance. I went around to the stage door and I asked the guard if I could leave a note for one of the actors. He said yes. I wrote, "Bob, I'm going to be in the audience tonight, and I'd like to come by for a visit after the performance." And I signed it, George McLeod. 17 years earlier, my best friend, Tony Dowell, and I were students at the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville when we signed up for our educational summer abroad. A student tour group organized by a history department professor named Mrs. O'Kelly. It was 4 weeks in Europe with the option to stay and take courses. Our group consisted of 8 girls, Tony and me. This was going to be a long way from Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, our hometown. We all met in New York in early June 1960 and boarded a ship to sail to Naples, Italy, where we would start our land trip. After a day or two on the ship, I noticed that Tony had been talking to a guy that seemed to be hanging around with our group. Tony introduced him to me. His name was Bob. When I asked Bob where he was from, he said, "New York." And when I asked what he did in New York, he said he was an actor. "No kidding," I said, suddenly more interested. "No kidding," he replied. I asked what his travel plans were, and he said that earlier in the spring he had been in a play in London. When it closed, he had flown back to New York, tried out for a play there, but didn't make the cut. He had left a few belongings in London, and his plan was to start in Italy and slowly make his way across Europe, ultimately returning to London, where he would recover the items he had left there. Well, a guy who said he was an actor and who was going to knock around Europe by himself for the summer was very intriguing to Tony and me. Bob the actor became our new best friend. Right away, Bob expressed an interest in our Arkansas accents. He began to mimic the way we talked. We thought it was funny that he was interested in our southern drawls, so we poured it on more heavily. Tony and I had a greeting we sometimes used. We'd heard it in our rural backgrounds growing up. It went like this. When we met, I would say, "Howdy, Tony, how's your mama them?" To which Tony would reply, "Well, just doing 100, George, how's yours?" My reply would be, "Well, just fine, come on in, hunker down and set a spell." Bob loved it. He worked at getting the cadence and the nuance just right. After 7 days, our ship landed in Naples, and our little group of Arkansas travelers went ashore and started our tour. Bob had gotten our itinerary. As we traveled, he would sometimes show up at our hotel. He was traveling on the cheap, staying in youth hostels. So when he appeared, Tony and I would let him take a hot shower in our hotel room. He would hang out with us and usually charm Ms. O'Kelly out of a free meal. He was interesting and fun, and certainly different from anyone we knew. We made our way across Europe. We learned a lot. We had fun. Finally, we arrived in London. Our tour broke up there. A few people went to summer school in various places on the continent, and Mrs. O'Kelly returned to the U.S. Tony and I were business majors. You could have expected we might have enrolled for 3 or 6 hours of credit of economics or business at the University of London, but Tony had a better idea. Simply stated, we had had all the economics and business courses we needed to graduate. As business majors, we were never going to get to take a foreign language. Why not go to Paris and study French at the Alliance Française? Sounded good to us. That was our plan. Before leaving London, Bob showed up. He retrieved his things there, and after checking with his agent, he decided he would go to Paris too. In Paris, Tony and I enrolled in the Alliance Française, which taught French to non-French-speaking students from all over the world. We went to beginner's classes in the morning and ate lunch in the student cafeteria. After lunch, we would pick out a section of Paris to visit. In the course of 4 weeks, we learned a little French and pretty thoroughly saw all the sights of the city. For a few days, Bob played the part of a student at the Alliance Française. He would meet Tony and me there at noon to have an inexpensive lunch in the student cafeteria. However, rather quickly, the school authorities caught on that Bob was not enrolled and he was no longer able to get in. Shortly after that, Bob appeared one day and said he had received a call from his agent and that he was going back to New York. He left in a day or two, and I thought it was the last I would see of this interesting character. Soon, our educational summer abroad was at an end. We returned to the United States. Tony, who had graduated in June, stayed in New York and entered the Merrill Lynch training program for financial advisors. Carolyn Harris, my sweetheart at the university, had graduated the year before and had taught first graders in Memphis for a year. I returned to Arkansas in mid-August, and we were married in El Dorado on August the 27th, 1960. As Carolyn and I began our married life together in Fayetteville, my trip was fresh in my mind, and I shared with her the fun and adventure of my educational summer abroad. And of course, I told her about the crazy actor we had met. The following spring, we were watching a TV show one night, and there on the screen was Bob. He was playing the part of a deranged criminal. He was good in his part. Over the next year, we began to see him in more TV shows. It was exciting. Then Carolyn and I went to see the great Southern movie classic, To Kill a Mockingbird, starring Gregory Peck. In it is this strange, silently lurking character named Boo Radley. Do you know who played Boo Radley? It was my friend Bob. Now do you know who Bob is? He's an Academy Award winning actor, Robert Duvall. I returned that night in New York to the theater to see the play. Before entering, I stopped at the stage door and asked the guard if he had given my note to Mr. Duvall. He said yes, he had. and Mr. Duvall had said he would see me after the performance. When the play was over, I went to the stage door. The guard greeted me and said, "Mr. Duvall is in his dressing room at the end of the hall." The door of his dressing room was open, and Bob was sitting on the edge of the bed. He looked up and saw me coming. Can you guess what he said after all these years with a perfect Southern accent? "Howdy, George, how's your mama and them?" Come on in and hunker down and set a spell. And we did.
George McLeod, a retired financial advisor, lives in Little Rock and is married to the former Carolyn Harris of El Dorado, Arkansas. They have three children, Scott, Matt, and Mary, and three grandchildren. In our next story, Pat Gillum meets a cousin and makes a lifelong friend in the summer of 1956.
Mike Ford, my city boy cousin, arrived at our farm from California one morning in June 1956. Life on our farm was a constant battle with assorted animals for our crops. Mike had never been out of the Los Angeles area before, so the stage was set. Soon after Mike's arrival, the raccoons attacked the corn patch, which was in the roasting ear stage, in force. Every coon in the bottom seems to show up at dark. My dog Tudor, Mike, and I were assigned the task of protecting our patch. I was excited to have someone with me, but I was just a little bit apprehensive about how my city boy cousin would do. But it wouldn't take long for him to figure it out. Early one warm summer night, we headed for the patch. No sooner had we reached it than Tudor was on a hot trail. Mike and I ran down a corn meadow. We could hear Tudor running toward us, knocking down corn stalks as he ran. A silent, furry shadow flashed in front of me, barely visible in the dim moonlight. Close behind came Tudor. All reason and common sense just left me, and I joined the chase, momentarily not noticing that I was doing as much damage to the corn as the coons were, tearing and scattering those stalks as I ran. Suddenly the game changed. The big coon turned to fight. Tudor, having better control of his senses than anyone else at the moment, jumped aside. I don't really think I made a decision to do what I did next, for I like to think my decision-making process is just a little bit better than this display. And I knew about coons. A coon like this can be a bundle of screaming and biting fury. They can often whip a dog, and they can kill them if they get them in the water. Anyway, I dived at the coon. I like to think that I reconsidered in midair, but I don't really think I did. I sat on that coon on my knees. I held that ringtail tightly in both hands while that masked face peered out behind me. The coon was strangely quiet, giving me a moment to consider my situation. I asked myself, how do I get off? When no sensible solution came to mind, I just called out, "Do something, Mike." He hit the coon on the head with the knife, and it just got mean. So I acted. I jumped up, planning to hold the tail by the right hand, slide my hunting knife out of its scabbard, and hit it on the head. But by the time I had began my draw, my fingers had just touched the handle when the coon went absolutely crazy. It was wrapped tightly around my right arm, biting and squalling, and my arm was just turning into sausage. I shook it loose, only have it to latch onto my right leg slightly above the knee. I was struck by a momentary flash of good sense, and I just shook myself loose from him. Now, Tudor joined the chase then because he was still a young dog, and he liked it better when the coon was running from him. Now, myself, I was in the heat of battle now, and I stayed close behind. Again, the big coon turned to fight, raking Tudor with his claws. When I entered the fray this time, the knife was in my hand and it was quickly over. We proudly carried that big coon back to the house, and I basked in the attention and the glory as everyone examined my wounds. We didn't think much about things such as rabies in those days. Later that night, as we lay in our sleeping bags on the hardwood floor in my room, scratching all our chigger bites on our legs good, Mike confided, "I sure would like to have some scars like that to take back to California." I felt a surge of pride swell right up in my heart. A few days later, Mike went down to run the traps we had set out in our corn patch, got too close to a squirrel or a coon or some such animal, and got his own battle wounds. For days, he pulled the scabs from those wounds so that the scars would be visible when he wore them back to California. As the corn matured, the crows moved in. Hundreds of crows. Our focus turned to them. Now, one who has never experienced the crow as an enemy cannot possibly appreciate the cunning and the intellect of a wild crow. Without a gun, we could get close, like the tame golf course variety of today, but with a gun in our hand, they knew what that meant, and we could get almost in range before they abandoned that ear of corn and they flew, laughing and calling to the others, or maybe at us, as they flew. Mike and I built a blind in the patch. As we entered, one guard crow always watched from the tree line. We waited hours. Not a single crow showed. When we finally gave up in disgust heading for the house, the crows would always flog in and cover the patch when we got out of range. One day, Mike finally discovered a chink in their armor. A crow doesn't count very well. We both entered the blind, one of us would leave, and the crows would flog in on top of the remaining shooter, discovering their error in math just a little too late. These crows also provided a source of spending money. The county had a 50-cent bounty on crow heads. You just simply show them to the county clerk and collect the reward. However, the first time we proudly set a fruit jar full of aging crow heads on his desk, he suddenly decided he could totally trust us as he fled his desk holding his nose. From now on, we would only have to come in and tell him how many we had. The summer was drawing to a close. Mike was ready to ride that train 3 days back to Los Angeles. When he arrived, he got a dog, named him Tudor. He bought traps and set out a trap line in the concrete jungle of Los Angeles. All he could ever catch were a couple of cats and some ground squirrels, though. Just this last summer, we met up again. We talked about the old farm. He told me that summer in Arkansas over 50 years earlier had influenced the course of his life. And as he talked about the many trips he made into the wilds of the West, I thought about that summer of 1956 and how my city boy cousin had turned country boy and friend. And I realized it had influenced the course of my life too.
Pat Gillum grew up in Wing, Arkansas, and he and his wife Barbara have traveled the world on a shoestring. Pat's blog is Forever a Hillbilly, and his book, Spreading Wing, hits Amazon in November. In our final story of the night, Susan Elder steps out on the town, and a friend helps her come back to earth in The Roller Coaster of Cool.
Dallas, 1984. I looked in my closet and panicked. I had to find something in there to wear to the coolest, hippest place in town. An emergency trip to the mall was out of the question. There wasn't enough time, and I was way too broke. I'd met a cute guy at a wedding that afternoon. Now I was supposed to show him around Dallas. In my mind, that had meant having to pick which Tex-Mex dive to go to for beer and enchiladas. But he already had a plan. He'd read a rave review about the new white-hot place called the Stark Club, and he wanted to meet there. Philippe Stark, who later went on to great fame as a designer, had just opened a nightclub near downtown that was Dallas's answer to Studio 54. There was an almost unheard-of cover charge of $10. Remember, this was almost 30 years ago, and that was if the guy at the door deemed you worthy of getting in. I'd heard of it, of course, but I'd never even considered going there. Now, let me just say, I did not fit in very well in Dallas in the 80s. I didn't have big hair or wear much makeup, and I often felt like the only girl in the room who had never been first runner-up of something. The world of trendy clothes and high-dollar clubs was foreign to me. After growing up in Arkansas, I'd lived in Portland, Oregon, where flannel shirts were the norm, before I finally landed in Dallas. Don't get me wrong. I had nothing against the Dallas types. I had lots of great friends, and many of them truly cared about the hot clothes, the cool places, and the rich guys. But Dallas men and I just never really hit it off. And it was always crystal clear to me that I just wasn't part of the Dallas scene. I was never going to be Sue Ellen or Pam. Nor was I searching for JR or Bobby. So, when I went to the wedding that Saturday afternoon, it felt like a cool breeze, if that's possible, in Dallas in August, to meet one of the bride's cousins. He was cute, interesting, smart, and he was from Connecticut, which meant that he probably did not own a belt with his name on it. These were all very good things in my mind. Cousin of the bride, Mark, gravitated toward my group of girlfriends, all co-workers of the bride at the Dallas Mavericks. We spent a lovely afternoon laughing and talking and trying to remember if Dorothy Malone, another of the reception guests, had been in the movie or TV version of Peyton Place. It was TV. Over time, the group thinned out, and eventually it was just Mark, another girlfriend, and me. Mark told us he'd never really seen much of Dallas and suggested we show him around later that evening. My girlfriend had plans and had to decline, but I told him I would love to. As a result, I found myself in full clothing crisis mode, staring into my uncooperative closet. I prayed I could assemble an outfit that would pass muster to get into the Stark Club. I finally pieced together an all-black ensemble and hoped for the best. It was dark by the time we met at the club, and the line had already snaked around the corner. As we neared the building, there were velvet-covered chains delineating the masses, like a deluxe version of the barriers for the lines at the roller coaster at Six Flags. But there was no cutout of a little man with an extended hand saying, "You must be this tall to ride." This was completely subjective. Our fate was in the hands of the hip stranger at the door. Mark and I had a good conversation while we waited. But as we inched closer to the doorway of reckoning, I got more and more nervous. I knew he would get in. I just hoped I would. Every time someone got turned away, you could see everyone else in line trying to reestablish the grading curve for cool. Even though this was not my usual kind of place, at this point, I really wanted to go inside and see what all the fuss was about. I held in my breath and my stomach as we finally got to the door. We got a quick once-over, handed over our money, and walked in. The ride was about to begin. It didn't take long to realize this was no Fern Bar. The Stark Club was a kind of cool I'd never seen before. There was a giant square room with a smaller square dance floor right in the middle, a full story below. Along the outside of the big square, there were floaty muslin curtains loosely dividing the space into lots of little squares, all filled with couches covered in the same muslin. The curtains were sheer, but added just enough mystery to make you wonder who was in those little rooms and what was going on in there. Mark suggested we walk around the perimeter of the club before looking for a seat to get the lay of the land. At that moment, Larry Hagman, J.R. Ewing himself, at the peak of his fame, strolled by twirling a cane, of all things. His entourage was mostly blonde and all beautiful. I had hit the jackpot. This is where the cast of Dallas hung out? And I had gotten in and was with a cool guy? How much better could it get? I was cruising on the roller coaster of cool. Just before we made it to the far side of the room, a voice shouted, "Susan Elder!" Unbelievable. Not only had I gotten into the cool place that the cool guy picked out, they were literally calling out my name. He might actually think these were my people. Susan Elder! Again, a bonus shout out. We both looked around the crowded room, anxious to find the source. How much higher can this roller coaster go? Then I saw my friend LaWayne. Yes, LaWayne. Of course. Now it all made perfect sense. She's outrageously funny and a dear friend, but her Dallas world was filled with limos, champagne, and rich businessmen. Mark and I began to make our way over to her golden crowd, but just before we reached her, she laughed, raised her glass in a toast to me, and shouted again, "Where'd you get $10? For a moment, I was mortified. Then it hit me, she was telling the whole hilarious truth. I started laughing and could not stop. She and I hugged and laughed some more. I finally managed to get my breath long enough to make introductions. The roller coaster ride may have ended, but not before this last, fast, fun ride back down. And Mark laughed almost as hard as LaWayne and I did. All pretense was gone, and I was free to be myself, live my own life, and enjoy every minute of the ride.
Susan Elder is the director of the Jim Elder Good Sport Fund, named after her late father. Her mother still lives in North Little Rock and makes her laugh every day. Susan offered to change LaWayne's name in this story, but LaWayne insisted on full credit. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? To all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.